Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in East Asian Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I am Dagena Dor, one of the hosts of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Dr. Bill Suo about his new book, Constructing Empire, The Japanese in Changchun, 1905 to 1945, published by the University of British Columbia Press in 2019. So, Dr. Suo, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So I wonder if you begin the interview by saying a few words about yourself and how you became interested in East Asian studies and particularly in modern Japan and modern China.
Well, I'm going to end up dating myself, I suppose, because I started off in with an interest in Russian history and language. And back then it was the Cold War was a little hotter, as it were. And so I was studying that, but Russian history is really kind of depressing after a while. Stalin gets into power and it's just one bad thing after another. And I finished university in 1982 and I was taking a class in modern Chinese history with Maurice Meisner at Wisconsin. And there was this new guy on the field, Deng Xiaoping, and things seemed interesting there. So I switched to do my MA in modern Chinese history. And while there, I got a job that brought me to China's northeast, the area, something used to be called Manchuria. And then I lived there for a while and traveled a bit and decided that, oh man, doing research in China might be challenging. And after some time off, I came back for the PhD and switched to modern Japanese history.
Oh, thank you. And where did you live in northeast China?
I was... The job had me on the banks of the Amur River of the Heilongjiang, and we were affiliated with a company in Jiangsu. But I was on the river looking at Chinese living on the south side and on the north side. At the time, no Soviet citizens were allowed to live within 5 kilometers of the river. So all you saw on that side were Soviet tanks kind of buried up to their turrets.
Wow, very interesting. Well, thank you for sharing that with us. So before we dig into the book, can you maybe tell us a little bit about how you came to write this book, Constructing Empire? So what led you to take on this topic?
It began actually with that job, because after the work was over, I was a passenger on a big freight truck from Jiangsu to Beijing. And we drove through all kinds of areas that hadn't opened yet. And so I had to hide my face at times. But we ended up driving through the city of Changchun. And I remember, you know, one town after another looked more or less the same. And then we drove through this town and it had really different architecture. And it was kind of stunning. And the truck drivers could tell me some things, but not much. And so I kind of filed that away in the back of my mind. And then when it came time to do the dissertation, I was trying to think of, okay, what are some topics I can dig into that would be interesting yet somewhat finite so I don't, of course, get lost in digressions. And so I thought of the city. And so I thought I'd dig into that. And of course, no matter what the topic is, there's all kinds of interesting niches to explore. And so it ended up taking a lot longer than I expected.
Great. And right? Again, for those of our listeners who might not be very familiar with the modern history of Manchuria and the city of Changchun, can you maybe give us a really brief introduction on the city and where it is and its place in also the geopolitics of really 20th century Northeast Asia?
Yeah, sure. Manchuria is a name that was commonly used before the war and has somewhat come back, I guess, amongst historians and other academics. The Chinese just call the area the Northeast because they're talking about the northeastern three provinces of China. And to call it Manchuria is sometimes anathema because it seems as if you're talking about an independent region from China's perspective. You don't want that. It's just part of China. So we're talking about the area that is northeast of Beijing, so north and east of the Great Wall of China. It's that part of China that's situated between Mongolia, the Russian Far East, and Korea. And it covers quite a large expanse of land, goes from the Amur River all the way down to the city of Dalian and the Liaodong Peninsula. So it's a big piece of real estate that became quite contested in the 20th century because at the start of the 20th century, it was not well populated. The Manchus had, of course, left the area in great masses in order to rule China when they conquered China in 1644. And they tried to keep their homeland free of foreigners. And so come the 20th century, with lots of population density growing in Korea and China and Japan, this became terrain that many people looked to, and it became kind of a contested space amongst Chinese, Koreans, Japanese. And there were also, of course, Soviet interests or Russian interests and later Soviet interests in the region as well. Foreign imperialists from Europe and the United States are also interested in it in terms of developing it for their own interests. So it's a really interesting part of the world to study because there's just so much going on and so much interest in it that results in a number of rivalries and conflicting views.
Yeah, I mean, Owen Latimore wrote this book, right, Manchuria, the Cradle of Conflict. So that also tells a little bit about sort of the views of the region.
Yeah, he's just one of many authors who wrote about that area at that time, because he wrote in the 30s. There's another one that's calls Manchuria the cockpit of Asia or something like that.
So your book mostly focuses on civilian contributions to the construction of empire in Changchun. And you argue that studies on the Japanese empire often focus on elite decisions or actions, but the popular dimension must also be considered to fully grasp empire's nature. So can you tell us a little bit more about why centering the popular dimensions of empire making is crucial here, especially in the case of Manchukuo?
Yeah, sure. The great man approach to history is one that should be put aside. And I'm not alone in saying that, of course. The profession, the discipline of history has lots of explorations of new and different angles. But in most of the books until recently focused on, you know, this influential man approach to history. So many of the books initially looked at the trials and travails of Henry Puyi, the last emperor, or of Ishiwara Kanji, one of the founders or the organizers of the Manchurian incident that resulted in Japan's takeover of the region, and those kinds of perspectives. Others looked at diplomats and other, you know, main big figures. And in recent years, or a couple decades, I guess, has been a growing interest in trying to uncover what average citizens did and how they were involved. And so in Japanese, there's a few books. Okabe Michio is perhaps the first that I'm aware of. But more recently in English, we have works by Louise Young and Sandra Wilson and Imer O'Dwyer in particular that focus on the roles of civilians in Japan and Manchuria that discuss their roles. Speaking more broadly, though, it's also important because if you just look at the people at the top, it's easy to put the blame only on them. And then the responsibility for building empires can be dismissed by labeling it or by blaming a few rogue figures. If you think about it from the societal point of view, then the responsibilities are much more broadly shared and have repercussions for the post-colonial era.
Yes, definitely. And just like it was a total war, it was also a total empire, right, in Louis Yan's words. And chapter one of the book, City Planning, now we're going into the meat of the book. So this chapter looks at how the Japanese built two different urban environments in Changchun. So one as a railway town designed and maintained by Mantetsu, or the South Manchurian Railway personnel, and another one as an imperial capital, which was jointly planned by the Mantetsu and the Kwantung Army. So why was the city designed in such a way, and what does this tell us about the Japanese colonial projects in Manchuria?
Well, it tells us several things. I divide it in two periods because there are two very distinct periods in one respect, but in a second respect that I'll get into in a few minutes, it's essentially just one period. In the first respect, the Japanese arrive in 1907, having defeated the Russians in the Russo-Japanese War in 1904-05. And starting in 1907, they start to build an interior treaty port modeled on the treaty ports elsewhere in China. The most famous one, of course, is in Shanghai, but there are, of course, treaty ports in Tianjin and other places across China. And the Japanese had built a couple of others previous in Korea and in Taiwan. So this was not entirely a novel experience. But once they start to build this treaty port, they make it much in line with what you see in other treaty ports in China and Taiwan and Korea, with a certain approach to urban planning, architecture, electricity, services, these kinds of things. And they're modeling their program on what the Europeans had done who were there earlier. And so in this respect, Changchun as a treaty port is much like other treaty ports. And so the Japanese are sharing in this kind of imperialist exploitation of China. After the Manchurian incident of September 18, 1931, the Japanese avowedly seek to create a grandiose imperial capital that is going to lead Manchuria, or the new puppet state of Manchukuo, as it came to be called, into a new era. And so they wanted something that was more appropriate. And so you get this grandiose architecture, you get these huge, broad boulevards that are lined with trees. You have large parks. You have power lines that are buried because they're deemed to be unsightful. You have wireless radio. You have an airport. You have a horse racetrack. You have all the things to make the city, you know, modern and grand, which is very different from the treaty port town that had been there before. And this new capital is located just south of the treaty port, so it's connected. There are streets connecting it, but it's a very different cityscape in terms of nature and size. The capital is much larger. Now, in the one way it's not different, though, is that both are designed, I think, to show Japanese authority and power. The first as a colonial power, and in the second stage as Japan, the leader and liberator of Asia, to use their perspective, to take China and Manchuria and later China and the rest of East Asia into a new era. And I don't think it succeeds, which we can get into perhaps more when we talk about the next chapter. But in terms of urban planning, it's the nature of using some Chinese tradition to harken back to that that wisdom in terms of locating the palace in a certain place and new temples in certain areas is not as central and authentic as it was, say, in Beijing, in which they got their ideas from. So it's more, the Japanese remain more committed to building a modern and intimidating city, I think, than the grandiose Pan-Asian capital that they were allegedly aspiring to build.
That's very interesting. So speaking of architectures and I guess the infrastructures of the city planning, the second chapter, Imperialist and Imperial Facades, which is the title, really digs into these tangible expressions of Japanese colonial architecture discourses. So what does the architectures in Changchun and these different facades reveal about the empire?
Well, in the treaty port, The architecture is more or less like what you see in other parts of Treaty Port China. And in fact, the architectural style that they use, historical eclecticism, is based upon the European precedent, and the Japanese embrace it because this is a modern style. And so they're building a town that is the equal of that of the other imperialists. And so it fits into that first era. The architecture of that era demonstrates this quite nicely. In the second era, after the Manchurian incident, the architecture is not only larger and grander, but they try to make it more Asian-inspired by putting Asian roof lines and other kind of Asian decorations on some of the buildings, and to try and show a blending of East and West, and in so show off Japanese ingenuity. And this is particularly associated with the government structures in the capital of Manchukuo, which is Changchun, renamed as Xinjing, new capital. And these capital buildings are arranged in a stately manner on one boulevard. And they're large, they're sprawling, they have interesting roof lines, but they don't really appear anywhere else. And so back to my other point, how things remain the same, there's a larger commitment to modernity. And so there's an imposing bank, for example, and an imposing structure in the telephone and telegraph company. And other buildings that are not built in this Pan-Asian style. And so there's, again, a facade of this imperial grandeur for Manchukuo. But most Japanese structures continue to be built in the modern international style that's common around the world in the 1930s. And I think there's a greater focus on that, despite all the adulation in the journals and the newspapers to this new style that's supposedly leading Manchukuo and quote-unquote Manchurians into a new era. And as a propaganda piece, Xinjing appeared to assert Japanese superiority and authority in a number of ways, including even a couple of buildings with Japanese architectural motifs on them. But I think most fundamentally, the city evidenced a commitment more to continuing modernity, because they tried to make the city as modern as possible. And so that meant large parks, and in fact, on a per capita ratio, much greater than any other place in Asia, and on a par with the parks in Europe or in North America, as their statisticians figured out. They also tried to make the city more beautiful by reducing the unsightliness of modern cities, such as power lines. By law, all power lines were going to be buried instead of, you know, marring the cityscape, as you often see in many cities today. The city was also given a modern infrastructure in terms of water, sanitation, and these kinds of things. And then, of course, much of the architecture outside of the official architecture continued to be in the more modern styles you were seeing around the world. So despite this kind of Asian superficial surface to the city, in many ways it was remained a more modern city. And by that, the Japanese were trying to say that this city was going to be a modern capital for this new, this fictitious country.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And in the architectures, are they also exhibiting some kind of imagination? Right? You talk about the imaginary quite a lot in the book, and sort of kind of imagination or orientalism, right, towards these Pan-Asian structures, but also a kind of imagination towards Western styles.
Yeah, in terms of an imaginary, what I was trying to get at there was how these structures, you know, dovetailed with other aspects of the Japanese Empire at the time, in particular the idea of Pan-Asianism, that all Asians could be brought together as one large, you know, family, so to speak, under the leadership of Japan, in order to carve out a new path in the world against the imperialist powers. And so this new kind of architecture fits into that discourse quite nicely. And you see it celebrated, of course, by the architects themselves. There's lots of journal articles and newspaper articles written at the time, and speeches made that, that obviously make all these linkages. But you see it broader. You see it in postage stamps. You see it in other forms of government publications. You see it in the money that's circulated at the time. But you also see it amongst civilian ideologues who are writing their own books and their own perspectives, which are also, you know, celebrating these ideals.
So chapter three turns to the economic developments in Manchuria and the city of Changchun. And here you not only address how the Japanese integrated the town's economy into the empire's, but also reminds us that Changchun actually had already been a really key regional trade hub in the Qing Empire before the arrival of foreign empire builders. So what's the difference about the economic expansion centered on the city under the Japanese Empire?
I included the section before the 20th century because I wanted to show that the Japanese did not build anything from scratch, which is what you get the sense from reading some of the Japanese books on this era. And so there is, of course, long-standing trade patterns. I mean, granted, sure, Manchuria was not densely inhabited, but it was inhabited before the 20th century. And so you have these long-distance patterns in trade in sable and ginseng and lumber. And the beginnings of other certain kinds of agricultural products, in particular soy. And so you see the soy trade especially pick up for fertilizers in China and even Southeast Asia. And so you have those patterns that the Japanese are able to exploit even more so once they come into the region in 1907. And they aid all of these, but especially soy, by building experimental farms to experiment with new soy varietals in order to increase production, by providing a growing railway infrastructure in order to transport the goods, in order to bring, and also to bring banking and other kinds of financial services in order to help really grow this trade, particularly for Japan's benefit, of course. But it also has the effect of luring in lots of Chinese settlers to the region in order to help expand. And so it's a cycle that is mutually supportive in order to attract even more Chinese who are, of course, living in increasingly densely settled regions in China south of the Great Wall. So the Japanese initial response is to really expand all the agricultural systems and other and earlier systems, so not so much sable because that's a dying commodity. But especially soy. And it's, of course, in the early 20th century that the Japanese diet becomes even more balanced on soy. Tofu and soy sauce and these kinds of things were not as common in the Japanese diet before the 20th century. And Japanese soy or Manchurian soy products come to help support a growing industrializing workforce in Japan, as well as help support Japanese investments because soy is then exported around the world. And this is when the whole world begins turned on to soy and its potential uses. And there's an article by, I can't think of his name at the moment, it talks about how the importance of soy was, how Manchurian soy was something like 3/4 of the soy that could be found around the world in the early 20th century or first third of the 20th century. So in the first stage, the Japanese really encouraged all that kind of growth, economic growth. And in the second stage, after the Manchurian incident, the Japanese start to develop Manchuria as a partner for industrial development. So having factories and production that would benefit Japanese industries in order to prepare for a more heavily industrialized society, in order to compete internationally and to prepare for war. The plans for Xinjiang, however, differed from those of other cities in Manchukuo. Instead of a large industrial infrastructure, the planners wanted this new capital city to be kind of a city on a hill. And so to that, there was no industrial infrastructure initially planned. It was going to be a capital city with beautiful boulevards and lots of parks and trees. It was going to have this new kind of hybrid architecture, hybridizing Asian and European forms, thereby kind of symbolizing a superiority, I think, to the rest of the world, and serve as kind of a propaganda piece for the puppet state. In terms of industrial infrastructure, they tried to keep that to a minimum, and it wasn't until later when they realized they really needed to have some. They did allow some light industry in the far northeast corner of the city, where the prevailing winds would blow any smoke or vapors away. Another issue, perhaps, in keeping industrial infrastructure to a minimum was to reduce the potential for any rioting or rebellion amongst any laboring classes in the city.
Thank you for explaining that. It's very interesting. And chapter four, going into the societal kind of dimensions of the city, this chapter is entitled Colonial Society. Here you remind us that the population of Manchuria actually exploded from at only around 14 million in 1900 to 43 million in 1940 under the construction of Manchukuo. And the population of the region basically tripled in just 40 years. So what did this dramatic change in demography do to the residential arrangements and the city arrangements in Changchun?
Well, the city grows pretty quickly as from a railway inland port to a quote unquote imperial capital. So yeah, the population increased dramatically over the first half of the 20th century. In Changchun, or Xinjiang as it became after 1931, there was over 100,000 Japanese by 1940, and altogether there was more than a million Japanese in Manchuria by 1940. And that's just the civilians. That doesn't include all the soldiers and other people who were there. So this is a large number of Japanese who are coming, but the number of Chinese who are coming are even in larger numbers. Because most of that growth was amongst Chinese looking for work in order to either supplement their incomes and sojourn for a few years in Manchuria and then going back home where it's warmer and where their families were. But it's not just Chinese and Japanese who are coming to this region. There's also a large number of Koreans who started coming to Manchuria, initially just right across the border into eastern Jilin province or eastern part of Manchuria. But eventually they continued to expand westward and found niches that they could develop agriculturally as well. There's a smaller population of Mongolians who I think actually decreased in number, but I haven't seen actual statistics on that. But I think many of them got pushed out and they kind of moved farther to the west and north. And as for the Manchus, they are also in declining numbers as well. So this region explodes in population, but it's primarily a Chinese settlement. As for Changchun or Xinjiang, it becomes primarily a Chinese city because by 1940 there's 360,000 Chinese in the city as opposed to only 114,000 Japanese. But they are confined pretty much to just certain sections of the city on the south and east. All of these new houses and apartment blocks that are built along these grand boulevards are pretty much reserved for Japanese and for those Chinese and Koreans who collaborate with them. I mean, there is some Chinese who are able to move into the treaty port, but when it comes to Xinjiang, they are kept out of these newer apartment blocks and buildings. So the result, of course, is that you have an increasing densification of parts of the city, which don't get too much development, whereas the other parts of the city that are grandiose are and celebrated for having a low population density because of parks and other things, they're pretty much enjoyed only by Japanese.
And here in this chapter, you spoke about this local imaginary in Changchun that was formed from really diverse actions within and also concerns for the city on part of its residents. So can you speak a little bit more about this idea of the local imaginary?
Well, in this chapter, I was trying to get at what it was like to live in this first railway town and then quote-unquote imperial capital. And I tried a number of ways to get at it, and I found some novels, some reports, and I couldn't find much. And what I ended up relying on mostly were newspapers, in particular the Manchurian Daily News, the Manchu Nichi Shimbun. And there was in this newspaper, there was a weekly report on Changchun, just as there was a weekly report for every other town or city, you know, in Manchuria under Japanese administration. And so I looked at a couple of years just to get a sense for what those years were like. And there's what I came across was lots of reporting on differences in weather, because of course Changchun is a much colder, drier climate than what Japanese are used to. I included a discussion of what kinds of concerns Japanese had living there, and this included fears of Soviet invasion, fears of Chinese warlord activities, fears of Chinese violence in terms of muggings, theft, arson, these kinds of things. There were, of course, Japanese crimes. They tended to be not violent crimes, so things like embezzlement and those kinds of crimes. But then the language that was used, the newspaper tended to resort to language using things like outrage and assault and much more blaming and critical of the Chinese. And that kind of makes sense if they're a small minority population yet supposedly in control of this much larger population. It fits in with what Joshua Fogel and others have looked at in other treaty ports where the Japanese are. So they're anxious. And I was trying to convey those kinds of concerns because this would help explain their support for incidents such as the Manchurian incident and eventually a larger war.
Yeah, and one of the ways that I guess the Japanese colonialists were trying to deal with this or these fears was the building of infrastructures, right? Like hospitals, schools, and also religious institutions, right? Can you maybe speak a little bit about these different things that they were building?
Yeah, that's also there in the reports in the newspapers, because the language that the Japanese use to describe their activities in not just Xinjiang but across Manchuria is one of progress. And in fact, one of the South Manchuria Railway's publications that kept track of their efforts is called Reports on Progress. And you have a report on progress for a number of years that Japanese are there. And they call it progress because they see themselves as bringing civilization to this part of the world, which is why I think I write in the beginning of the book that the Japanese perceive their activities through a civilizational lens, because they're bringing infrastructure like hospitals and schools, electric power, sanitation, fresh water, all these kinds of concerns, you know, in some respects doing what the British say they're doing elsewhere in the world, but in a much larger way, I think, if you compare Japanese imperialist activities to either the French in Indochina or the British in India or elsewhere. This language of progress is something they can affirm and defend, which is also the flip side of this, of the anxieties that they are living amongst. They are also trying to create something that is worth supporting and defending.
And how often and how kind of frequent do the other residents of Manchukuo, the Chinese, the Korean, and even the Mongols, use these new infrastructure kind of places like hospitals and schools and religious institutions?
Yeah, well, there's the rub. Most of these new facilities were for Japanese only. There's very few built for the Japanese. And when it comes to hospitals, most of the new medical infrastructure I could find was run by European missionaries who set up places in the older parts of Changchun where the Chinese lived. So yeah, these were primarily for Japanese.
So the city in a way is highly segregated, I guess.
Yes, very much so. And I found in trying to find information on especially Chinese lives in this era, which is really difficult, I went to a number of missionary archives in Europe and I went to Edinburgh and to Belfast in Northern Ireland because there was a Irish Presbyterian missionary presence in Changchun from around the turn of the century, and to Paris. And in Paris, I found some reports by some French missionaries that described the segregation, very nicely. And I've got that in the book, how the Japanese are living in this modern kind of Asian New York, whereas the Chinese are pretty much living as they had been for centuries in thatched roofs, all in the same city.
Yeah, so the other side of the story, I guess, is very difficult to tell. The majority of the population in this, I guess, metropolis of the empire, their stories, how they lived in the city, it's not very visible in comparison.
Yes, and it's a story that needs to be told. And one of the reasons why it took me so long to get my book out was that I tried for years to find contemporary accounts of how Chinese, Koreans, and others lived in places like Changchun. And I just couldn't. I mean, the Japanese were really good at censoring newspapers, so you can't find any accounts there, which is why I thought I'd try the missionary archives. Oral interviews only go so far because I tended to get the same answers from a number of the older Chinese I talked to when I was in Changchun and other parts of Manchuria. And so it was quite frustrating.
Speaking of memory, your last chapter of the book actually turns our attention to Manchuria in the immediate post-war years of the Japanese Empire. And here you also talk about how the city and the city living experience was perceived and remembered, right, in the post-war by its ex and current residents, both Japanese and Chinese. So what was the fate of Changchun right after 1945, first of all, and also secondly, how was the city kind of remembered in the post-war?
It's, in terms of your first question, Japanese and Chinese in Changchun and Koreans, although Koreans tended to be more rural than urban, faced a number of calamities. First, there is the end of the war itself and the Soviet invasion. The Japanese initially had planned to retreat to the mountains on the Korean border, which would have meant just giving up the cities to Soviet forces. And since the bulk of the Japanese were living in the cities in the central part of Manchuria, they decided in the end to actually fight and make Xinjiang or Changchun as the kind of the defensive pivot, because it would be like the northwestern pivot of the defensive lines. And so the result, of course, was Soviet bombing runs and eventually armor breakthroughs through the borders and then paratroopers landing in Changchun and starting to organize the Japanese surrender. And of course, it happened very fast. The Japanese were expecting a Soviet invasion. It just was several months before that they anticipated it. So everyone was caught off guard. And there's all kinds of stories, of course, of Japanese trying to get to places like Changchun in order to get to the rail lines, in order to escape to either a ferry and back to Japan or to get to Korea and escape. Chinese, of course, were less concerned about that. And in fact, I found evidence of uprisings in this capital at the very end of the war, and where some Chinese killed their Japanese officers and raised the flag of rebellion in the final days of the war. So they're quite happy, of course. But then afterwards, Changchun becomes a pawn in the Cold War, because eventually it is contested between Chinese communists and Chinese nationalists, and there is a brutal battle where Changchun is besieged. You have 100,000 people dead because of the siege and the communists not allowing any food getting into there. And so when that's over, the communists take over and then continue on their march to win the civil war. Most Japanese by then, but not all, were out, having escaped south just before the siege, usually to the south and then by American ship back to Japan. But a number are stuck in Changchun or other parts of Manchuria and don't get back until the early 1950s. But that route home for those who do make it back is difficult because they have to endure cholera, they have to endure the winter of 1945. It's impossible to get out. Most don't get out until 1946 and 47. And so they have to figure out new ways to survive in the era where your entire system had broken down. There's no more cash. You're fighting for your survival. There's Soviet troops that threaten to kill all the Japanese if there is any attacks against them. There is the fear of rape. There is the fear of Chinese communist guerrillas who occupy the city before the nationalists get in. There's a lot going on that is quite scarring for many Japanese. And that's also part of the story because, sure, the Japanese remember Changchun or Xinjiang often with these visions of progress, of the things they did before the war. But those who came back remember the pains and the deaths that occurred in those tragic years from 1945 to 1947 in particular. And then, of course, with some 600,000 Japanese are detained in the Soviet Union for various amounts of time after 1945 until through the 50s. And some of them were taken from Xinjiang streets as well. So in terms of the Japanese post-war views, as I say, some of it is they see the city as a bastion of progress because there were a number of publications into the 60s and 70s even about what good things that the Japanese were able to accomplish. And of course, they don't really discuss the bad things much. And it's really not until the 1970s that you start to see Japanese criticisms emerge. And I actually have an article in a book edited by David Edgington that talks about this is called Post-War Manchuria in Japan. And when I talk about these post-war views and how it takes a while for criticisms to emerge. And then when they do, when discussions of Unit 731, for example, or which was that medical experimentation and chemical and bacteriological warfare experimentation on Chinese up in the city of Harbin. Changchun had its own unit. It was Unit 100 that did these kinds of things. When those come to light, people start to say, well, wait a minute. Some of the things the Japanese did were every bit as bad as the Nazis. And so the post-war views are quite conflicted. And one of the reasons for focusing this book on civilians is to bring this question to light. I mean, the experience included all of these things. Japanese could be said in some ways to have done some things that were progressive, but they also did things that were barbaric. And so how do we consider the entirety of this experience?
Yeah, it's definitely a very complicated issue. And so how is the city kind of remembered now in current residents of Changchun?
Well, last time I was there, I talked to Chinese in Changchun, and universally, you seem to get the same condemnation there as you get elsewhere in the Northeast, that the Japanese were barbarians. The Japanese devils did this, they did that. And you agree because there were awful things done by aspects of the Japanese army, elements of the Japanese army. And then I start to ask them about the built environment. And I would often get statements like, well, yeah, they did build some good buildings and they tend to last longer than what was built by the Chinese after 1945. It tended to be darker as well because they had smaller windows and things like that. So you do get a kind of a more ambivalent view if you can steer the conversation in that direction. And in the post-war era, when the Japanese have gone back to China, they refused to pay any indemnity, but in order to facilitate better relations, there's been lots of Japanese overseas investment in China, particularly in infrastructure in terms of water supply systems and transportation and these kinds of things, in order to try and reestablish some kind of relationship.
Thank you for answering that. And there's one more question I'm kind of curious about is, do you also see a current kind of interest in the region in Northeast China by the Japanese government or by, say, private companies or corporations nowadays?
By the Japanese government, I'd say no, unless you count the encouragement of this kind of overseas investment strategies. Amongst academics and the populace, though, yeah, if you go to any Japanese bookstore, you go to the history section, there's always a section on Manchuria, or so it seems. A lot of it, of course, is celebratory or reminiscent of how things used to be, and celebrating Mantetsu and things like that. Occasionally, there's NHK documentaries that talk about this era. But there's also been a kind of a surge in publications since 2000. There's been a couple of books and discussions in journals that become books. And there's even been some joint academic publications by Chinese and Japanese scholars that have been exploring this history. So yeah, there is interest amongst academics and in some of the population, but not by the government that I'm aware of.
Thank you. Well, we've come to about 50 minutes already. I think we've taken up a lot of your time and I really had a great time reading your book. But before we let you go, we have the final question for our, channel is, can you maybe tell us a little bit about some of the projects that you're working on right now?
Well, this year I actually have a sabbatical that started the first of the month. And I had planned to go back to Japan and perhaps elsewhere in Asia to do some research because I finished up several projects in the last few years and I wanted to get some new material. That's obviously not happening. So instead, I'm going to focus on one aspect of the book, which is to further explore the medical aspects because sanitation, hygiene, were big concerns of the Japanese, and in the era of COVID, that makes a sense to revisit what I have here on the treaty port and look at the medical concerns of the treaty port. And I'm trying to develop an article on that right now.
Very interesting. Well, thank you for sharing that with us. And I guess we can let you go. And thank you so much for taking your time to do this, to do the recording with us. And I look forward to your article and maybe your books coming out soon.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.